give a talk. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'll be telling you about work that has been going on for some time with Chris Beam, Pedro Liendo, Leonardo Rastelli, and Balfanres, and that should come out very soon. On the superconformal bootstrap for theories in four dimensions with n equals 2 supersymmetry. And in my title, I added this word maxi bootstrap, mostly to distinguish it from what we've been informally calling the mini bootstrap. So this is kind of an aside, this slide. You've probably heard many talks on this already, and I'm hoping to show you some new results, hopefully, that you haven't seen yet. So it was recently found that superconformal field theories in four dimensions with n equals 2 supersymmetries or more, and also in six dimensions with n equals 2, 0, that you can carve out a protected subsector of operators that is isomorphic to a two-dimensional chiral algebra. And this chiral algebra has very interesting consequences, but I will not go into it at all in this talk. That would fill a full talk. But the very direct consequence of this is that when you write the bootstrap equations for operators that are captured by this two-dimensional chiral algebra, they will split into two sets. One, which is simply the bootstrap equations for the 2D chiral algebra itself, and it involves only the exchange of operators which are captured by the chiral algebra. And this set of crossing equations we can solve exactly, and that's what we call the mini bootstrap informally. And then there's the full-blown four-dimensional crossing equations, which involves all operators, protected and protected operators. And these equations are much more complicated and must be studied only numerically. And this will be the subject of my talk. And so I'll take a very practical approach that I won't have to mention the chiral algebra story at all. But when we study the crossing equations for a particular subset of operators, we'll find that they split into two, and we can solve once, and the others we'll analyze numerically. So this is the outline of my talk. I'll start by a very brief review of what is a conformal bootstrap, and then I'll tell you what we aim to do with the superconformal bootstrap program, which multiplets we are interested in studying, and then I'll tell you about the results for these two multiplets. So we take a conformal field theory to be defined by a set of local operators and all their correlation functions. And since in a conformal field theory, we have the operator product expansion, which has a finite radius of convergence. We can reduce any, by multiple uses of the operator product expansion, we can reduce any correlation function basically to two-point functions. And the only information we need to supply is, so I'm taking the operators to be scalar for convenience, but you can do it for operators with spin as well. And then this sum, I'll take it to run only over conformal primary, since the information about the conformal descendants are basically obtained by acting with derivatives. So the information about all the descendants is encoded by these factors here, which are completely fixed by conformal symmetry. And the only unknowns are these three-point couplings, which are basically the coefficients that appear in the three-point function, and also the spectrum of operators. So I can completely specify a theory if I tell you all of these three-point couplings and the spectrum of operators, meaning their dimensions, their spins, and other quantum numbers that they might have. But the idea behind the conformal bootstrap is that not anything goes, and this information is very much constrained by imposing basic consistency, which will be unitarity, and associativity of the operator product algebra. And so let me quickly review how we'll implement associativity through the crossing equations. So we can take the double OP expansion of a four-point function. So I take the OP of these two and n of these two, which I pictorially draw like this. And it can be expanded in these conformal blocks, which are basically the C squared with the OP coefficient squared up front. This sum runs over all the operators being exchanged. But it should be invariant for the exchange of 1 and 3, say, and so I should get the same answer by doing pictorially what looks like this. And this is the crossing symmetry equation. And implementing crossing symmetry for all possible four-point functions in the theory will be equivalent to implementing the associativity of the OPE. And so I can write this crossing equation as this sum rule, running over all the sum of all operators, where I excluded the identity operator contribution there. And then there are these unknown coefficients, and this piece is completely fixed by conformal symmetry, just a conformal block minus this crossed. I am calling F delta L. And solving these equations is very hard in dimensions larger than 2. and the recent revival in this bootstrap approach came from the work of Ratazzi, Richkov, Tony, and Vicky, where basically the idea is, let's say I make some assumption about the spectrum of operators. Let's say there's a huge gap in one channel, in spin zero, say. And then if I can find a functional acting on this that is positive and also strictly positive on acting on the identity, then this can never be zero, and I effectively ruled out the theory. Since searching the space of functionals is very hard, what we'll do in practice is restrict ourselves to a finite dimensional subspace. But at each step of the way, if I fix a finite dimensional subspace, if I find such a functional, I rule out the assumptions. So each bound I find is valid. But then we can ask the question, what happens is if I increase the search space and the bounds will get better and better, but at each step I'll always get some valid bound. Now in all these, I never had to mention any Lagrangian or any perturbative expansion or anything of the sort, so this is very useful to tackle theories which don't have a known Lagrangian description. And that brings me to the superconformal bootstrap program. So there are two types of questions we can ask. We can ask what is the space of conformal of superconformal field theories, what's the consistent space. And for maximal supersymmetric theories, we have a well-known list of theories, we have some idea of what can happen. Well, we have an idea of what should happen. And we can ask, say, in six dimensions, series with n equal to 2, 0 supersymmetry. It's what is the minimum central charge for an interacting theory? For instance, we know the minimum central charge we know of is the theory obtained just by 2 and 5 brains. Can we have series with central charge smaller than that? And by numerical studies, we seem to find that no, we cannot. That's the minimum allowed in the unique theory at that particular value of the central charge. But what I'll be telling you about in this talk is series in 4 dimensions with n equal 2 supersymmetry. We have a large list of theories, and many of them, most of them, do not have a known Lagrangian description. So this seems like a very nice tool to try to understand them. And this brings me to the second goal, which is, can we try to use this bootstrap approach to study specific theories? And this will be particularly helpful if the theory is uniquely specified by a particular discrete set of data, say a theory with a 6 flavor symmetry. And this is the only tool available for some of these theories, such as the 2, 0 theory in 6 dimensions. We've been studying this theory as well, but I will not have time to fit both 4 dimension and 6 dimension in one talk. I'll be happy to tell you about the 6 dimension story in private, but I'll be focusing on 4 dimensions from now on. And so what do we want to study? What do we want to bootstrap? Which correlations functions should we start to look at? Well, I mentioned a theory with a 6 flavor symmetry, so one natural thing is let's bootstrap the flavor current multiplet. More generally, and I'll be telling you about this one later, more generally you could ask bootstrap the operators in the Higgs branch chiral ring, but I will not be talking about that. You can also, and I'll be telling you about this, you can bootstrap n equal to chiral operators, who's the superconformal primary of these n equal to chiral multiplets. They're VEV parameterized the Coulomb branch chiral ring of the series, so you can be focusing on series with a given Coulomb branch by studying this correlator. And although this hasn't been done yet, it's also a very natural multiplet to study, the stress tensor multiplet. And we definitely want to do that. So let me start by the flavor current bootstrap. So the flavor current multiplet in the classification of Dolan and Osborne is part of this set of multiples, the B-hat-Rs. So these are multiples that obey a shortening condition. They are annihilated by these two particular supercharges, the highest weight. And this split of the crossing equations will happen for the superconformal primaries of these multiplets. And I'll be, so the name might be a bit unfamiliar, but for instance, the B-hat 1/2 multiplet is just a free hypermultiplet. I'll be focused, so the superconformal blocks for these multiplets are known for the primaries, and I want to focus on the B-hat 1, which is the one where the flavor current sits. So since this multiplet contains the flavor current of the theory, all the fields in this multiplet will have to be in the adjoint of the flavor group. And the primary is a scalar of dimension 2, and it's a triplet in the ratio 2R, and it's just the moment map of the flavor symmetry. So in a Lagrangian theory, it will be something like QQ tilde, where these I's, IJ, are ratio 2R indices, and these are the scalars in the hypermultiplet, and then the flavor current is obtained by acting with two supercharges on it. So what do we expect when doing the OP decomposition of this multiplet? First of all, there's the identity operator. Then we find again the same multiplet to the same operator. And this three-point function of b hat, since, well, I'll be looking at the moment map three-point function, and since the flavor current is in the same multiplet, this three-point function is just fixed in terms of the flavor current central charge. Then we find another multiplet in this set of multiplets, b hat 2. But we also find the stress tensor multiplet, which is this one. And so the central charge reappears through this OP coefficient. Then we find some other multiplets, which include higher spin currents, so currents with spin larger than 2 and which are conserved. And these are expected to be absent in an interacting theory. We find some other short multiplets that are not that familiar. And all of these multiplets here, they are short. Their dimensions are fixed from supersymmetry, from superconformal symmetry. But then we also find some generic long multiples and protected with arbitrary dimensions whose spectrum we can try to constrain through this bootstrap. And so to do this bootstrap, we need to input what is the flavor group we are looking at. And then we have these two handles on K and the C central charges. So how will the four-point function of this look like? The ratio 2R triplets. So let me omit the flavor structure for simplicity. I'm denoting this A index is an adjoint SU2R index, and I'm just, to make things look nicer, soaking up all the indices with these null vectors, but we can always reinstate the indices if you want. And so in the OP of two of these SU2R triplets, you'd expect to find three channels, singlet, triplet, and quintuplet. But they are, all the three channels are related by superconformal symmetry, and in particular, superconformal ward identities were shown by Dolan and Osborne to fix the four-point function to have this form. So here, U and V are just the usual cross ratios, where I also defined in Z bar. And W is a cross ratio for these SU2R vectors. And this four-point function is completely fixed in terms of this one function of two variables and a single variable function. And now let's write crossing symmetry for this four-point function. And it turns out to neatly split into two. One equation involves only this f of z, which is a single variable function. And the other will involve both. So this is precisely the twisted correlator in chiral algebra, if you're familiar with that story. So the mini bootstrap is just that statement that this crossing equation can actually be solved exactly. And it can be fixed, it's solved exactly and up to one parameter, which can be fixed in terms of the three-point function of three moment maps, so in terms of the flavor central charge. But since we know this F explicitly, and we know that it will, if we decompose it in blocks, it will receive contributions, turns out, from only protected operators. We can just decompose it in blocks and read off the OP coefficients of all of these operators. And it turns out that by decomposing it in blocks, we are able to fix all OP coefficients of protected operators after we assume that there are no higher spin currents, and we also should input this, we need to input the central charge of our theory. So since we have these OP coefficients, we should still demand that their square is positive. And that's how we found in our previous paper these new unitarity bounds on the central charges of the theory, where here this is the dimension of the adjoint, and H check is the dual Coxeter number. But now we want to do more. We want to bootstrap all of the operators in the theory. So we want to bootstrap this two-variable function, which receives contributions from both short and long multiples. But since we know all long, all short multiple Topi coefficients, let's just input that and write the crossing equation for this long piece. And schematically, it will look like this, where so this is very similar to the sum rule I showed you before. We have a sum that runs over all the unprotected multiples in the theory with some unknown OP coefficients, and we also don't know the spectrum. And this F long is now the super block minus its crossing. And then we have this F short instead of the identity. And this F short is the G short minus its crossing plus other contributions that come from the one variable function F. And this is the equation we want to study numerically. And in practice, we solve the problem of finding these functionals through semi-definite programming techniques, which I will not go into the technical details, but we can talk later if you're interested. So this has to be analyzed numerically, and we will be able to both bound the spectrum of long multiplets and OP coefficients. And in particular, this F short was completely fixed, but it depended on two parameters, the C and K central charges. So we can also find bound on the C central charge, as we vary K, say. And numerically, we'll be able to find lower bounds on C. Remember that the analytic bounds, and now I'm focusing on E6 flavor symmetry, were upper bounds for the central charge. So now numerically, we'll be able to complement them by lower bounds. So let me first focus on E6. This is what the bounds look like. And we know of a theory that saturates both bounds. It's simply the E6 theory of Minahan and Emshansky. And this is kind of a side comment, but the saturation of these bounds also has a very clear meaning. It means some multiple is absent, which is a known Higgs branch chiral ring relation, the Joseph relation of the moment map. But now we can ask what other central charges are allowed. And this is what we find. So I'm plotting here the allowed central charge. So this is central charge versus 1 over k. And this red region is the analytically excluded region. And there sits the E6 of Minahan and Emshansky. And then this gray shaded area is numerically excluded. And all these curves are increasing the search space dimension. And one common feature in all the plots I'll be showing you is that we don't see convergence quite yet. We see that the curves, the distance between consecutive curves is getting smaller, but they haven't converged yet. It seems to be a feature in this n equals 2 bootstrap, and especially since we have such a big group, this kind of a stopping point. Each point in this curve took 2 weeks to run. But we can try to extrapolate where these points are going. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem that this minimum will reach there, which would have been very nice. But maybe if we study other correlators, mixed correlators, we might get something else. And the rest of the plot is rather featureless. But now let me show you what happens for SU2 flavor symmetry. So the two analytic bounds are now these. And while we know of series that saturate this lower bound, we do not know of any series that saturates this upper bound. So we can ask the question, is there something living there? And just I told you before, the saturation of these bounds had a clear meaning. And while this one is still some Higgs branch chiral ring relation, this is just an absence of some more unknown multiple, so it doesn't have that nice meaning that you might expect a theory to saturate it. And actually, you shouldn't expect, because so now I'm showing you the same plot, but for SU2, red again is the analytically excluded region, and the intersection would be here. So this is the K bound, this vertical line. And you see that the numerical bootstrap quickly excludes all of these points. So there is no theory actually saturating the first bound. And we see that this bound is actually moving up on this curve, and it seems to be reaching there the values of the free hyper. And you see here the convergence is really slow. It's still moving quite a bit. But there's this funny region here where it's pretty much almost stopped. So there seems to be some solution to crossing symmetry here that's preventing the bound from going any higher. And we do not know of any theory which lives there. So this is this is the free hybrid, has 1/12 central charge. It is lower than that. We do not know of a theory which has a small central charge. So could it really exist? There are some bounds known on what central charges are allowed. So the Hoffman-Maldacena bound for n equals 2 supernormal field theories is this. Unfortunately, we don't have a handle on A. But there is some rule that can that was derived by Shapiro and Ishikawa for series with a Coulomb branch, which is freely generated. And it relates this difference between 2a minus c with the sum over all the Coulomb branch generators. And delta is the dimension of the Coulomb branch generators. So let's try to combine these two bounds. And we find this bound on the central charge. And unitarity also requires that these dimensions are all greater than 1. So in particular, the central charge has to be greater than 1/6. So if these assumptions hold, if you have a freely generated Coulomb branch, then the central charge has to be greater than 1/6, which ours is not. So this theory cannot have such a Coulomb branch. It will be a very, if it exists, it will be a very exotic theory. Of course, for a theory to actually exist, one single correlator is not enough. We should have looked at all possible correlators. And in particular, this minimum C might be ruled out by some other. Say, let's look at the stress tensor bootstrap. It has a finite central charge, so it should have a stress tensor. So this correlator for sure has to work out. So now this is kind of an outlook slide. This stuff we haven't done yet. But since I'm finishing this flavor current bootstrap section, I'm telling you about this. So the stress tensor multiplet has this name in the classification of Donald and Osborne. And the first step for us to look at this is to find the superconformal blocks. They are not known yet. One nice thing is that the superconformal primer is a scalar. So we can bootstrap the multiplet where the stress tensor sits in without having to do the block expansion of a spin 2 object, which is technically challenging. But unfortunately, this separation between mini and maxi bootstrap will not take place, so we'll just have numerics. What is captured by the chiral algebra, and so we expect this, we'll have this mini maxi bootstrap, is the SU2R current, which sits in the same multiplet. And it's actually sensitive to both C and A anomaly coefficients, so this is another reason why we would like to do this bootstrap regardless of that minimum. And maybe from the mini bootstrap, we could find some analytic, some non-trivial analytic bounds on C. But for sure, from the maxi bootstrap, we would have numeric bound on CNA and maybe shed some light on what that minimum is. So now let me change multiplets. And I'll be going to the n equals 2 chiral multiplets. So these are multiplets that are superconformal primary killed by all supercharges of one chirality. And the VEVs of the superconformal primary parameterize the Coulomb branch chiral ring. So you can now define which theory you are looking at by specifying what's the Coulomb branch of that theory. So in a Lagrangian theory, there will be something like trace phi to dr, where phi is the scalar in the vector multiplet. And the superconformal primary of this multiplet is a scalar of dimension fixed in terms of its U1R charge, which in my conventions for U1R charge is just delta equals its charge. And we won't have the nice split between a mini and a maxi bootstrap, so we just have the numerics to go with. So this allows us to study theories with a Coulomb branch operator of a given dimension. And the Coulomb branch is believed to be freely generated for all known series. And I've shown you this bound before for a freely generated Coulomb branch. So now can we try to improve on this bound of any different bounds on C? I'll be studying a single correlator, this one right here, of chiral, antichiral, chiral, antichiral. So I can only hope to capture completely series with a single Coulomb branch generator. So in that case, the bound reads this. So can we improve on it? So we will find the central charge in the chiral antichiral OP. So this is the OP in addition to the identity. We find the stress tensor as expected. So this is where our handling the central charge comes in. Then we'll find again some higher spin currents and some generic long multiplets. And the superconformal blocks were also computed. So let me show you what bounds we find on the central charge. And here we are. So in the previous case, the dimension of the external operators was fixed. It was 2. But here we can vary by varying the 1R charge. So we can ask what's the minimum bound on C for different dimensions. And this is what we find. So here I'm plotting C versus the external dimension. And this gray area is, again, the numerically excluded for increasing search spaces. And this red line is this bound I just showed you. And here, this red dot is the free vector multiplet. It doesn't look like it, but the bound sharply drops here and does not exclude the free vector multiplet right below. But then it attains this maximum where it's actually stronger than this bound. And the closest theory to this curve that we know of is this Algiers-Douglas theory of rank 1, which has no flavor symmetry, the H-naught theory. So you can actually hope that the bound will reach there. But then our bound gets very weak. And up here, this is practically 0. But it was also expected that the bound would decrease since we are looking at these operators, but in no way we specify that they are generators. So for instance, at r equal 2, we know of a theory which has central charge 1,6, which is the free vector. So we shouldn't rule out this point. So the bound was bound to, we never inputted that this is a generator. Of course, if the external dimension is smaller than 2, and since unitarity requires dimensions to be greater than 1, all of these operators have to be generators. There's no other option. So now I've never shown you yet bounds on operator dimensions. So let me bound the dimension of the first spin 0 long appearing in this chiral antichiral channel. And first, I will not specify what the central charge is. I'll just add the stress tensor block with an arbitrary coefficient. And this is what I find. So this is an upper bound. I'm varying the external dimension. And what this is telling us is that you cannot impose a gap larger than this black curve for this dimension. Otherwise, if you do that, there is no solution to crossing. And so this is the dimension here. And you see that actually it has converged pretty well in this region. But the convergence is a bit slower as you increase the search space dimension here. This dashed blue line is just a factorization line. So it's delta equal to 2r, which would be the bound for generalized free field theory. And we see this funny shape in the plot. It attains a maximum as sort of an inverted kink. So let's try to shed some light on this by now fixing various central charges. So this is now the same type of bound, but now a three-dimensional plot where I vary the central charge. And this red wall is just this bound right here. And now, to clarify this, let's take slices of fixed central charges and overlap the arbitrary central charge plot. And okay, this is what we find. Let me take a minute to explain this plot. So I'm plotting again the allowed dimensions versus the external dimensions. And this dashed black curve is the arbitrary central charge bound. And now let's start by this side. The first line that's actually overlapped with the arbitrary central charge line is the infinite central charge. And then as you decrease the central charge from infinite central charge, it goes down. And for finite central charge, it's actually allowed to go below the factorization line because generalized free field theory has infinite central charge. But now if I look to the other side, as you decrease the central charge, the bound actually goes up. And so you see that the shape of this curve is being controlled by very small central charges. And OK, now you can ask, so these are very small central charges. And if the theory has a Coulomb branch, that is freely generated, then you shouldn't have central charges smaller than this value. So let's ask, what's the bound for this central charge? And it's this red line I'm plotting here. So you see that the bump is central charges that are smaller than this. And then there's this point where the bound actually drops sharply. What's happening here is that this central charge is too small and is no longer allowed by this bound. So that point corresponds exactly to this point here.
So what's happening right in the center?
Yes, I'll get to that. So there's this difference in behavior here. As you decrease the central charge, the bound gets weaker, and here it gets stronger. And then there's this crossover point where no matter what the central charge, the bound always seems to have the same value. So here it seems that the bound from the plot I showed you before, the bound seems to have converged, but here not so much. And so it actually might be that this bound will still come down and maybe to meet this line. And why am I suggesting that? Because so this intersection happens exactly at article 2, and something special happens for the chiral operator of dimension 2, because it has inside the multiple there's an exactly marginal deformation. Four supercharges acting on the superconformal primary gives you a scalar and everything, SU2R, and it has exactly dimension 4. So all theories which have a dimension 2 operator, chiral operator, will have a conformal manifold. So you could imagine going to a region in the conformal manifold where your series is weakly coupled, and then you'd expect the dimension to be 4. And if this bound actually reaches 4, what this is telling you is that as you move away from that weakly coupled point, the anomalous dimension should be negative, because only dimensions smaller than 4 are allowed. And it actually seems, so since convergence is much slower here, it actually seems plausible that this bound, it will go down to this factorization line, because here you see that infinite central charge is speckly on top of the factorization line, which means that generalized free field theory saturates the bound for infinite central charge, and that seems to be a recurring feature. So it's plausible that this will actually go there, and then this minimum will be exactly at 2 and 4. So I've been talking only about the epsilon-epsilon bar channel, but we also have an epsilon-epsilon, a chiral-chiral channel. And there, DOP has all these rather unknown multiplets. But this multiplet appears again, another n equals to chiral operator of the dimension twice the external one. And so he's another operator on the Coulomb branch. And we can bound its OP coefficient. Now, in this channel, each of these multiplets can only contribute with one conformal primary. So the superconformal blocks for this channel are nothing more than the usual conformal blocks. And this guy contributes with the superconformal primary, which has dimension 2R0 and spin 0. And all the others contribute with blocks of larger dimension. So there's a gap between these operators and all the others, which means that we can numerically, we can bound, not we can find upper and lower bounds on its OP coefficient. So before, I was showing you lower bounds on the central charge, which are actually upper bounds on the OP coefficient. But now, since it's, the block is isolated, we can actually do both. And by placing lower bounds on its OP coefficient, we can actually probe relations on the Coulomb branch chiral ring. So this is a three-dimensional plot where I'm showing the external dimension versus the central charge. And this bottom sheet is the lower bound, and this is the upper bound. So your OP coefficient has to live in between these two surfaces. This red wall is just a central charge bound for a freely generated Coulomb branch. So if your theory has a Coulomb branch which is freely generated, it should sit, the generators should sit on this part here. And you see that the bound is strictly positive for quite a big range of external dimensions, and it's going to zero, and it will go negative, so the bound should be just zero. So, but this is for a finite dimensional search space. The bound will get better as we increase the search space. So let me show you now like a horizontal slice. I'm showing you the region where this bound is strictly positive. It's this shaded region here for increasing search space dimensions. So you see we can already rule out relations of this type, only chiral chiral is zero on this region up to this dimension, but it's still moving quite a bit. This red line is just the central charge bound I showed you before. Okay, so this was, I could only do this type of bounds, but of course, it would be interesting to study series which have more than one Coulomb branch generator. So we should look at mixed correlators of different operators like that, and then you could probe more complicated relations. So to summarize, I hope I'm motivated by the next, a very natural next step would be to bootstrap the SU2R current, since then we could get bounds on A and C. Of course, multiple correlators are something that definitely must be done. This bootstrap program is just beginning. We only did these two flavor symmetry groups. Of course, you could do other flavor symmetry groups, product groups, etc. But in particular for these chiral and equals to chiral operators, we would like to do multiple correlators to study higher rank theories and probe Coulomb branch relations. It will also be interesting to study mixed correlators of operators that are captured by the chiral algebra, so where this mini bootstrap appears, because then you could find bounds relating the various central charges and get some more analytic results. But also from the numerics, it would be interesting. And while this chiral algebra has played a very important role in the story I told you here, a better understanding of the chiral algebra is necessary to study more complicated series. And so a step was taken in that direction by studying series of class S. And then later we also conjectured the generators of the chiral algebra for TN series, but more a better understanding of which chiral algebras can correspond to four-dimensional series is also needed. I didn't have time to tell you about TN because, but I'll be happy to talk about it in private if you're interested. So let me just finish with a six-dimensional bootstrap plot since I have time. So in six dimensions, we are looking at the stress tensor multiplet. And so let's look at the first unprotected operator. Again, here the story is a bit different. So we also have this mini bootstrap story, and it fixes the OP coefficients of almost all the short multiplets. But there are some short multiplets that live at the unitarity bound of the longs, which are not captured by the chiral algebra, and so we don't know their OP coefficient. So let's just assume they are there and add them and try to bound the first long after that. And I'm showing you the bound in the spin zero channel. So let's bound the dimension of the first of superconformal primary of the first long multiplet. And the bound we find is here. So this is the biggest gap you can impose. But series do not have to saturate the bounds. We are just finding a bound. Your actual theory could live below the bound. And the plot I'm showing you is for central charge equals 25, which is in our convention, which is precisely the central charge of the two-brain theory. So I don't know if my theory saturates the bound. Let me see what happens if I assume there's an operator with some dimension varying from the unitarity bound, which is 6 in 6 dimensions for this long multiple, until the maximum bound I can impose. So let me add a block of a given dimension and try to bound the first operator, the second operator after that. And we find this kink here. And this kink happens precisely at a special point. So I told you I assumed the short multiple set the bound were there. But for the A1 theory, it's expected that they are not. So if I remove the short multiples, I find a lower, stronger bound, which is exactly this value. So this kink is telling you that the theory actually does not have that multiple and should live there. And in, at this point, precisely the OP coefficient of that multiple is going to zero. And okay, since I still have some time, I can show you some 6D plots. So in the beginning, I told you that the minimum central charge seemed to be the one of the two brain theory. So now I'm, instead of fixing the central charge, I'm varying the central charge and finding the bound on the first unprotected long and assuming all the short multiples are there, the ones we don't know about. And so this red line is C equals 25. And this here, when the bound reaches unitarity bound, it's telling you there is no solution to crossing. And so these central charges are too small and are ruled out. And this is moving. And it seems to be moving towards C equals 25. So since, again, we have a very small, a slow convergence, so the best we can do is try to extrapolate where the bound will end. I'm plotting the inverse of the, as I increase the search space dimension. And this is a central charge bound. And that's the two-brain theory. So it seems actually to be going in that direction. And okay, I think I can stop here. Lower bound on the dimension? Numerically?
Yes.
No, we just have upper bound on the dimension. Oh, of. Oh, what do you mean? Oh, no, unitarity demands the dimension should be greater than one.
But can you get all the way there numerically?
Yes, we vary it all the way there, and, well, you have the free vector. Yes.
How much of this would continue to be useful if you had less supersymmetry?
Well, it has been done by other people. They have similar bounds. They actually studied n equals one chiral, anti chiral operators.
Okay, no more questions. Let's thank you.